Blog Talk Radio.
This is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith, and this episode is called To Serve and Protect. With all the increased reports of police brutality and militarization of police departments across America, today DSD wants to take a look at our communities and the police activities that are taking place in our communities. Not only discussing the police activity, but our own activity, the actions we take when black-on-black crime, which has been a counterpoint of the right and the conservative of, you know, black and black crime, when we're killing ourselves and not sharing information with the authorities in a practice known as no snitching. How can we protect and serve our own communities and deal with the police that are patrolling inside of our communities in such a way that we no longer see them as an occupying force and they no longer feel as they have to be an occupying force? The DSD crew is ready today to go down south and dirty. Harlem, ATL, share some knowledge, share some light on this issue and drop some knowledge.
Bless you, brother. Appreciate you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. To protect and to serve, that's the topic. W.E.B. Du Bois once said, "A system cannot fail those it was never meant to protect." I want you to think about that for a minute there. I want to talk about Michael Brown and Ferguson as the United Nations gets involved and issues a statement. Police brutality violates anti-torture treaty. Finally, there's a global exposure given world attention to this situation and to this case. I want you all to realize how important that is to have the UN make a comment on it and talk about how United States is violating the anti-torture treaty. It's the case of the executioner and his subjects, the agitator versus the victim, through force and violence. So you ask, what does this mean when the UN gets involved? When the police cross the line, what are the outside pressures that can be enforced? Can sanctions be placed upon the U.S.? That's something that we need to discuss in this top hour. To protect and serve and police brutality, what comes first, the establishment or the people? Who and what are the police protecting when the people live in a community they don't own any property? Who are the police really serving? We need to discuss that in detail. The black family across the nation must move differently. This is my opinion. We have to stop glorifying ignorance. That lifestyle only leaves us in jail and dead. We have to transform the mindset of gangs and illegal activity in our community. We have to restructure and unify. Second, we have a dress to kill issue. Dress to kill versus dress to be killed. I want you to think about that. Not trying to tell you how to dress, but I want you to be aware of your actions. I want you to be aware of the mindset that you currently have and how you affect your community and how you affect others in your community and how the world views you. Improper use of language and the code of conduct while in public. What you do behind your own closed doors, that's your business. You're entitled to. But when you come outside, we have to impose a united front, complying with police and not resisting arrest. We need to deal with law. When we deal with law enforcement, we have to be educated and knowing how to deal with law enforcement. We have to learn our rights as a colonial subject. Now, I don't want you to be upset or pissed off when I say colonial subject, but you have to remember how you got here. You have to remember what the Constitution, how they view you. You have to also remember whether or not if you have human rights or you have only basic civil rights. Do you know the difference between the two? I want to talk about cleaning up our community and not defacing and destroying property. You know what I'm talking about. Urinating in the hallways, staircases and alleyways, home invasion, car theft, especially you cats out there stealing cars just for fun. How smart is that? Education and travel. Now, I want you to understand the importance between education and travel to broaden our national and global scope. Education and travel. Education doesn't mean that you have to be within the four walls of a university. You can open up a book and travel. You know, you don't have to get on a plane. Controlling our dollar and the power of the vote. Overstanding our collective spending power. I want to talk about overstanding and understanding. There's a difference when you overstand something and when you understand. Children understand. Adults overstand. Knowing the difference between understanding and overstanding, that's definitely something that we need to get in contact with, talk about that in a roundtable discussion, possibly even open up a new forum for the next one, which is going to be review of reparations. That may be a new topic. That may be also a whole separate show, just discussion. There's just the discussion alone, and taking our plight to the U.N. I want you to know how important that is, the U.N. to get involved when you talk on a human scale across the diaspora. Malcolm X, my spiritual father, came to mind when I was thinking about this. This is the man that gave me my manhood from the grave. We have to stop calling it racism. The racial environment has been changed. You heard what I said. The game has switched. Switched to class, sex, and economic power. They got racism. They have right now, they currently have racism for free. And we could talk about what it means by racism for free. It's thrown in. Having a black president is nice. I love Barack Obama. He's a good look for us, and he's doing a great job. But we need more black gates. We need black people to be in position to create 400,000 new jobs to stimulate the economy here in America and abroad. We have to do this our own. We can't wait for somebody else to do it for us. We can't continue to wait for handouts. So I want to discuss some of the solutions to our problem. We're playing a game right now that we can't win. Not with the present mindset that we have, not currently. Whites and Europeans control almost 100% of the wealth, power, resources, and privileges. They control all levels of government and government form. When we talk about racism, we must talk about Jim Crow slavery. We must talk about Jim Crow slavery first. Not just slavery, but Jim Crow slavery and benign neglect. You don't know what benign is? Look it up. Slavery is an illegitimate child of racism. That's what slavery is. Racism keeps and maintains what was created by slavery. Racism is a competitive economic struggle between groups of people, of power and wealth. It's a competitive group contest between people for race, resources, and for superiority. Do you understand that? A race between resources and superiority. Understand the structure and the model. You have slavery. That's when the ships, the dock, the good ship Jesus. If you know anything about the good ship Jesus, that's the first interaction that Africans had with the name Jesus coming over here. They didn't read it in a book. Remember, they wasn't allowed to read. They knew nothing about Jesus. They knew nothing about the European aspect or concept of God. We had something else. You had slavery first. Then you had racism, which was transformed into racism in the 1600s. Then it was transformed to biological. And then to personal behavior in the 1800s, or attitude, a particular attitude. To now what we have today, bias and prejudice. Racism is a race without a finish line. Did you hear what I said? Racism is a race without a finish line. You have to understand what you're up against. That is why we need to follow the model of the Native American Indian for demanding reparations for the black nation. We need tax-exempt land. And you have to understand that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is us. It appears that she doesn't want us here. However, some of our people act as if they don't want to be here as well. Our actions, some of the dumb shit that we do, doesn't help our situation. Excuse the language, but I'm keeping it real with y'all. In fact, let's just keep it real. We have to change the perception that we give upon others about us. If you live in the hood, it's your responsibility to do better for yourself. Educate yourself. Get out the hood or make the hood better. There's no boogeyman pissing in the hallways, the stairwells, the alleyways. There's no little rich white man spray painting graffiti on the walls. No, that's you doing that dumb shit. That's you stealing cars for fun. That's you breaking into people's homes. Look at yourself and reflect on what you're doing. And most important, observe how you affect the community in which you live. Now, camera phone, record that shit and snitch on that. Why don't you? You feel me? How about getting an education so you can make a difference? So our children, so our families can look at us, look up at us, opposed to looking down on us. Why don't you earn your woman's love and respect? Christy, you have any insight on this here? Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Did I lose you?
Oh, no, I'm here. I just called in to listen. This is Joan. I was just listening.
Hey, Joan. How you doing? I can't find anybody. It seems like I may have lost Christy or and Elliot.
Oh, okay. Oh, you lost them? Oh.
I don't know what's going on at this point.
I'm here.
I don't know if they have
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
I'm here.
Okay.
I was talking, but I guess no one can hear me.
No, I didn't hear a word that
you
said.
But I was, because
oh, okay.
I just did a whole little. Okay, cool. That's what happens. People, this is live. We have technical difficulties sometimes, you know. But I was just speaking on the fact that you were talking about glorifying ignorance. And you, how that's a possibility. That's a whole other show in itself. And talking about, one, how young people are not going, you know, young people in travel and education, and how that, you know, reading and exploring your boundaries and broadening your horizons is a very important thing, because I know right here in the where I live at now in Troup County, I know when we first brought the Kia plant here and people were talking about, you know, that was a big news write-up about how many people were leaving the state and the county for the very first time in their lives when the Koreans were taking them overseas to train them. So many people are not broadening their horizons, and they only see as far as they can walk. I mean, so, and people don't walk far these days. You know what I'm saying? And I'm sure it's probably, you know, this is a rural area, but I can see the same thing. I've seen the same things happening when I was growing up in Atlanta. Some people never left Gresham Park other than to go to work. You know what I'm saying? They went to work. They went to wherever they worked, but everything else they did inside of Gresham Park. So that's the only impact of their world was Gresham Park. So, I mean, you know, and I'm sure the same thing happens in New York. Certain people never leave Brooklyn. Some people never leave Queens. You know, other than,
I could speak on that. I know some people who live right across the street from Yankee Stadium and never been inside Yankee Stadium. I know some people that have never went, who live in Harlem, who never went past 116th Street, you know, never seen 34th Street, don't go downtown, don't even go into Brooklyn. So I think it's about us stepping out of our comfort zone. Can't be afraid to step out of our comfort zone. I have a few people that...
Welcome to Down South and Beauty. Caller.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, how are you?
This is Jared Ellison.
Hi, Jared. I would like to introduce Jared Ellison.
Hello.
He's going to be our legal expert. Jared will give us legal advice about basic, simple things that we can do to prevent basically harassment and police brutality, specifically when you just look at young black youth, male youth. Before Jared gets started, I would just like to say, and these are some of the things that I would like to address with Jared as well. I spoke with a loss prevention officer. His name is Steven. And when speaking with Steven, he told me that usually he sees on a day-to-day basis a lack of respect for authority. And usually that's what escalates the situation. The reason why I bring that up is because if you look at the acts that Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown were doing, they were simple day-to-day activities. Trayvon Martin was leaving the store. Michael Brown was walking in the middle of the street. But you'd have to ask yourself, what would cause a person who's simply walking from the store and walking in the street to end up to a point or escalate to a point of death? So I thought it would be a very good idea to bring a legal expert on who could provide us with some information as to how we can lessen this tragedy or protect ourselves. Jared, please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Jared Ellison, and I'm glad to be on board, and I will answer any and every question I can. And I'm glad Christy brought up the point about respecting the, you know, law enforcement, because one thing we totally find is that usually law enforcement will give an instruction and it's completely ignored, or someone attempts to argue with law enforcement. And most of the time, if you just listen and just abide by it, you know, you'll be free to go on your way. And so, but we can discuss all of that whenever you all are ready.
Well, Jared, let's jump.
Well, before we go ahead and do that, I would like to go ahead and just remind everybody out there that's listening that this is a show that you can call in. It's interactive. So if you want to call in, you have the number 657-383-0995. And I'm going to repeat that one more time. That is 657-383-0995.
Jared, I just have a question that I would like to challenge you on, especially for our listeners. We all hear that if we behave in a certain manner, if we respect ourselves, then we'll have less problems with the police. How do we protect ourselves in situations where the behavior is good? I would like to reference a Facebook post that I saw of a gentleman who was, he was an African-American male. He was simply waiting, I think, just waiting outside to pick up his children. And as he saw his children approaching, the police officer stopped him and said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, "I'm simply waiting to pick up my kids." The police then asked him for his ID. He said, "What have I done wrong?" And the police said, "Could you please hand over your ID?" At that point, you know, he started questioning the officers why, because he was just simply waiting. In those types of situations, from a legal standpoint, what would you suggest when the behavior is not disrespectful?
Well, even if the behavior is not disrespectful, the police officer did ask him to hand over his ID. I mean, if he didn't have an ID, he could have simply said, "I don't have my ID." But in that case, to avoid an escalation, he could have handed over the officer his ID, officer could have checked it out, then he could have got the officer's name and badge number, and then went and filed a complaint against the officer. So it would then be on record. I mean, so there are ways around it. I mean, yeah, a lot of times people want to question authority, and we don't agree with what they do. But at the end of the day, if it's going to save your life, then you have to consider that and take that into account.
Okay.
I got a question also here. To down the similar lines, because that was another video that I saw just yesterday that came out of Alabama, that we had, there was a group of gentlemen, they were actually on their own property. They were sitting on their front porch, and the police drive up to them on their property, and they asked them, you know, for their identification. And it just happened there was a young man that was there, and it was his wife's home. I guess he travels for work. I don't know the backstory or whatever. But he came and asked him, he said, you know, what is your purpose for being here? And they was like, well, we got suspicious activity involved. Do you suspect us of being a part of that suspicious activity? No, we're just checking it out. You know, so are we being, again, some of the guys wanted to go in the house, and they wouldn't allow them to go in the house. They said, well, are you detaining us? And they're like, no. And it went on for like 15 minutes until the guy asked for a supervisor. The supervisors came out. Now, in that aspect, when you have the police coming to you on your property and are asking you questions, you know, well, how are we to handle that at that particular point? We're not in a public place. We're actually on my property, which I own.
Well, again, you don't want to escalate the situation. I mean, it's already a bad situation to be in. So when the police came, evidently they're saying they had a reasonable, articulable suspicion to be there. So then, of course, they started asking questions and they had some concerns. And when he asked for an ID, of course, you know, you could say, hey, am I free to go? Because if the police say, yeah, you're free to go, at that point, you can just then simply walk away or not say anything. Or if the police say, hey, you're not free to go, then you can say, hey, you know what? I'm gonna take my right to remain silent, and I request to speak to my attorney. And then the police at that point have to make a decision of what he wants to do. Because if he arrests someone, then that's going to be a charge of false arrest that you can then sue for, because you do have civil rights. But it's a matter of how we handle it. The problem is we don't always know our rights, because police do violate our rights every day. And people think it's a new phenomenon. It's been going on for years and years. The only difference now is everybody have a cell phone with a camera on it and a recorder. So that's the only difference now. Now it's just being caught and brought into the light.
Derek, can you go ahead?
But even on your own property, a police officer, if they have reasonable suspicion or probable cause, they can come on there and ask questions. Now, can they search your home or your person without your authority or without a search warrant? No. Unless they got probable cause, then that's a little different. But if they see you out on the street and you're on your own property standing there, they can't just come in and say, hey, they want to search you, because they would need a warrant or your authorization. And you don't have to give your authorization. You can always say, no, you're going to need a warrant for that.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I would like to know, in the case of when suspects or citizens are walking with possibly the smell of marijuana on them, is that probable cause for the police to pull you over and search you based on what he or she smells?
At that point, it's a fine line between that reasonable suspicion and that probable cause, and that's been debated in the court systems. A lot are going to say, and it depends on where you are and what state, some are going to say, hey, that was definitely probable cause for a police officer to stop you. You know, they smelled the marijuana. Others are going to say, no, that's only a reasonable suspicion where they can only ask you questions. So it's a fine line depending on what state you are in. But now, of course, if they stop you if they pull you over in your vehicle and you roll down your window and they have a big wafting smell of marijuana and smoke come out the window where you just put it out, then, of course, that's probably probable cause. You probably don't get around that. But that will probably give them the right to search. In most states, some states are going to still need to get a warrant to search, because it's not going to rise to probable cause. It'll just be a reasonable suspicion.
But even though if it's probable cause and they haul you in, they're going to search you before they take you in. They're going to look to find something, and it's going to take you to have to go another route to try to sue after the fact that you've been processed. You've been searched. You've basically been violated, especially if it's different if they find something on you, you know. But how does a person deal with that
when they're walking the street? You're right. Because the problem is, you know, we're kind of like a police state where, you know, he who holds the gold makes the rules, basically. And in these cases, police officers are one of the guns and authority. And so, yeah, we do want questioning, but we want to do it in the right way. And a lot of times we don't want to be behind closed doors necessarily, because that can get you killed, as we clearly see, or when it's really private. But, you know, in Ferguson, that was really public. But you do have to handle it smart. You have to say, you know what, he's searching me illegally, and you know what, I'm not going to speak, and just say, I want to speak to my attorney. You know, and, of course, at that point, they're supposed to. They don't always. They're supposed to stop right then and there and let you call your attorney. Because you are, once you're arrested, you are entitled to one phone call. You know, and, of course, the best thing to do if you don't have an attorney, get a family member on the phone, a parent, a sibling, a cousin, somebody, and say, hey, look, I need you to find me an attorney to tell them what's going on and explain to them quickly the facts. So that way somebody can come down, even if it's from the public defender's office, to come down to see what's going on, to make sure your rights are not being violated, because at that point they probably have been if they already decided to search you.
That's definitely very helpful. Could you explain protect and serve when it comes to the establishment? What comes first, the establishment or the citizens? Especially if the citizens don't own any property.
And that's the problem. You know, citizens don't own any property, but with protect and serve, you have to say, who are we protecting and serving? They're supposed to protect and serve the citizens, and then the establishment comes second, because the people you are to protect. Because think about it. It's the taxpayers that's paying your salary. It's the taxpayers that's putting you in that uniform. It's the taxpayers that's making sure, you know, you have a position there in that department, have an establishment, have a vehicle. So the people you're protecting are the ones that's your boss. Your boss is the taxpayers. But unfortunately, that's not what happens. We have people that hire up in office, or they get into office, and they become the establishment. They're the ones that say, hey, I'm going to make the rules that suits me or that's best for my needs, or that only like a certain race of people, and this is who we're going to look out and protect. That's when they're protecting the establishment. But that's not what it's designed for. It's designed to protect all people, regardless of race, creed, or color.
I got a question here, because I was doing research for the show, and this is Scout. I was doing research for the show, and there was some, you know, obscure Supreme Court case sitting out there. And I think it was actually out in the Midwest somewhere, where they actually, the Supreme Court of a state, it wasn't the Supreme Court of the United States Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court of a state had said that the police there did not have, that was not their primary duty to protect the citizens of their particular jurisdiction. It was their job to enforce the law. And it was like, wow.
Right, and that's a baffling decision, because when you're protecting the law, what are you doing? You're protecting the citizens, because you're making sure the citizens are actually safe. So, I mean, I'm not familiar with that court decision, but would I have challenged it? Should they have taken it to a federal level? They should have, because, and I don't know if the court just said what we call three-judge panel, or they said en banc, meaning the full court. If it was only a three-judge panel, then they should have made it, you know, appealed it to became en banc, meaning the entire court, to listen to that. Because I would have a problem with a policy, public policy in history, of saying, hey, I'm just supposed to uphold the laws when the laws are designed to protect the citizens. So at the end of the day, you're looking out for the citizens. Because once we only abide by what the law says and not look out for the citizens, we're going to have a problem. Because the two should actually go hand in hand, not one and the other.
Is it thrown out the window when it comes to martial law?
Oh, I mean, you know, and that's the problem with martial law. I mean, because with martial law, they're kind of doing their own thing. I mean, there was a jailer recently, a sheriff out Midwest or the West, where he was basically doing his own thing. And with the prisoners, he had them doing every witch thing he wanted them to do. And he didn't care about what the feds said or the state said. And, of course, you know, eventually there was lawsuits filed, because people realized, hey, these people, mainly blacks, rights were being violated every single day. But it took somebody actually standing up and taking a stand and announcing this, because you got to bring it to the light. You know, if you never bring it to the forefront, we never know about it, nothing's going to be done about it. So you have to make noise about it. It's kind of like that saying, you know, the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So you got to think and be loud and, you know, make a disturbance, unfortunately.
What do you recommend? What do you recommend in regards to when we have a plight, we have issues, do we take our plight to the wolf's den, or do we take it to the UN?
You know, unfortunately, that's a dilemma. But I think we have to look at it from more than one angle. I think we have to take it every way we can. But I think one of our biggest problems is we don't all stand together. We normally are divided, and that's one of our problems. But if we're going to be divided, at least have a stand. At least some can stand one way and some stand the other, but fighting for the same cause. So we got to take the battle every which way we can. But we, like I said, we just got to stand united. I mean, the protests in Ferguson, that was fine. There was a lot of peaceful protests. But then you had a few that wanted to go out and violate the law, just to violate. And that's not what it's about, because then they see, and the news is going to always show African Americans in those situations in a negative light. But unfortunately, most of the African Americans there was protesting peacefully. So you have to take the protest back to them. I mean, so you protest in front of City Hall, you protest in front of the jail, you protest in front of the sheriff's office. You let them know, hey, we're not going to stand for this anymore. And you be smart and you take a legal fight. And if the state courts won't hear it, you get the Department of Justice involved on the U.S. federal level, and you call your senators. And that's the other thing, we don't vote. So, but we got to get involved politically, let our senators, our representatives know on the Hill, hey, we're not going to take this. And if you allow this, we're going to vote you out of office. We're going to vote somebody in office that support us. Because I hear a lot of people today still say, oh, I don't vote because my vote don't count, when they fail to realize that every vote counts.
Right. I have one last question. I want to know, do we have human rights?
You know what, we do have human rights, but the only way you're going to get your human rights if you take a stand for your human rights. The government is going to say, hey, we have the Bill of Rights, but the Bill of Rights is different from human rights. I mean, can you make it into a legal argument? Huh?
Yeah, can you explain that, the difference between Bill of Rights and human rights, and which one comes first in this country when it comes to us?
Now, that's a very good question. With the Bill of Rights is like your right to speech, your right to bear arms, and, you know, your right to vote. So those are basically those rights in this country. Your human rights is, hey, you have a right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. You have a right to be able to live freely. You have a right to be able to eat every day. You have a right to be able to go to work. Those are your basic human rights, meaning having your basic needs for life met. So, you know, having a place to live. Those are your basic human rights. You know, not being violated. But in this country, what comes first is the Bill of Rights, constitutional rights. They're going to trump it, unfortunately. Should it be that way? No. Now, some are going to say, oh, well, a lot of the rights, they overlap. And some do, to a certain extent, overlap. But at the end of the day, you have to understand what our country is all about. It's about whoever has the most money makes the rules. And the person with the most money isn't trying to lose money. They're not really trying to bring up anybody that's poor. They're going to keep their money in their pocket and leave the poor people poor. So, and that's what people say, well, how does slavery in this world still exist? Slavery exists. I mean, there's a sex trade that's here in the United States and other countries. It exists. But we have to know, okay, what are our legal rights then? If our human rights are being denied, what are our legal rights to ensure that we can restore our human rights? And the only way to do that, again, is to vote. Because you got to vote people that's going to think like you, that's going to be concerned about your welfare and your well-being. And those are the ones, the Congress is the ones that makes the laws. And when they make laws, they can make laws to protect us. You know, that's how we got the right to vote. There was people like us that decided, hey, you know what, we need to give them a chance, and they need to be able to vote. And even with Thurgood Marshall on the court, you know, of course, he was really for the people, especially African Americans. Because I hear some people now saying, oh, you know what, we don't need affirmative action because everything is equal. Well, I hate to tell you, everything is not equal in our country. As we could clearly see, if you're a black man, you at a disadvantage when it comes to authority.
Jared, I'm sorry for dominating the conversation, but I have to ask you, do we have a case for reparations?
You know what, there's always a case for reparations. But the real question is, will we ever get those reparations? And the answer is probably no. But does that mean we shouldn't make that fight? We should, because think about it. I mean, we were robbed of our ancestry. We was robbed from our home, or at least our ancestors was. We was brought to a country that wasn't ours. We were enslaved and worked for free, literally for free, for years. About 200 years we were in slavery in this country. And we didn't get a dime, a penny. We didn't even get a thank you. Make it worse, we didn't even get an apology for slavery. I mean, all we did was now say, you know what, y'all free, y'all can go get a job. But then, of course, who had all the jobs and all the land at that time? It wasn't us. So can we make a case for reparations? Yes. The problem is when you look at our courts are still predominated by whites. And there's always that slave mentality somewhat. And they're going to say, you know what, but things are equal now. There's better. You have blacks that are billionaires and are millionaires and a lot of money. But that don't take away from what happened to us. So,
I would just like to interject for just a moment, Jared. You brought up an interesting point about human rights. I'm more of one to focus on the human rights because of what I see happening within the black community. I think that whether we realize it or not, the economic squeeze is sort of forcing us out of our human rights to such basic things as health care, just having, you know, like you said, the right to eat. You hear about so many kids now that are going, they're hungry, they're going without food. What I have right now, what we have on the line is a community advocate. Her name is Janice Kirkland. I spoke to Janice, and she made me aware of a traumatic event that happened to her son. And because of that event, she became an advocate in her community. She talks to parents about everyday things that they can do to help enforce their human rights. Janice, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. My name is Janice Kirkland. And my son was shot 8 times. He was being robbed when he was on his way to see his grandmother to Atlanta. She was dying. And he passed away the night he was shot. He was shot 8 times. And he pulled through and he made it. But my thing was, he was shot and killed for $300. The boy that shot him was 16. And he was an African-American boy. And my thing was, when he got shot, his mother took no responsibility. She took him and the gun, took his bloody T-shirt off, put it in the trunk of her car with a gun, and took him to her mother's house, who lived a couple of counties away. His mother worked for the court system at the time. And that made me wonder, how could you have a 16-year-old son and you call yourself a responsible parent, but you didn't teach your child to do the right thing? If it had been my son, and I told her this in court, I would have made him change his shirt. I would have took the gun, but I would have drove him to the police station. You know, go ahead, I'm sorry, Christy.
Now, Janice, I want to ask you some questions about that situation. So you're saying at this point that you would have driven him to the police station. In that situation, how did that lead you to becoming a community advocate?
Because you see parents, when you see educated parents, not black, white, green, or yellow, just a parent, what you're teaching your son is, you can do something, and there are no consequences. You know, I believe in standing beside your child. She should have stood beside her child, but she should have stood beside her child and made him do the right thing. And the right thing was, first of all, not have a gun, and second of all, you can't commit a crime and there be no consequences.
Now, I want to tell you guys, I had a very interesting conversation with Janice before this call, and I got a very different perspective on the situation that happened to Michael Brown, just talking to Janice. Janice made some comments to me that, you know, she said, when it comes down to it, she said, you know, the kids had no business walking in the middle of the street. And I brought up the fact that Michael Brown had been in the store, harassing the store owner, and she said, well, that had nothing to do with the case if you think about it, because when he was stopped, he was only stopped and asked to move out of the middle of the street. She said it comes down to common sense. She said that she as a parent feels that she should tell her children, you know, stay on the sidewalk, don't get in the middle of the street. If a police officer stops you,
please obey. There are some things that she made me aware of, if Janice, you don't mind me talking about it. She was stating that she tells parents when it comes to privacy, there should be none. You should be able to go into your child's room, young black males, young black females, search their room, because she says that now, and, you know, I didn't realize this until I really talked to Janice. She said, back in the day when we were growing up, and I'm a late 70s baby, you had orange and yellow guns. They were very distinct from the toy guns, from the real guns, I mean. She's saying that today you have guns that are packaged that look just like real guns. And she found that in her son's room, and she said, hey, this has to stop. You know, she's already had one tragedy. So, Janice, I would like for you to talk more about that so that people can have some understanding of what would happen if their child were to simply, I mean, think about it. We just had an incident not too long ago. I think it was a 12-year-old that was shot because he had a toy gun, and people were upset about that. But should we be upset, or is it that, you know, as Jared has mentioned, that the law enforcement has a right to protect themselves as well?
Correct. And the gun that boy, that young man had, the 12-year-old had, my son was, my youngest son, I think he was 13 or 14 at the time. And I went in his room one morning when he went to school, as I always do, looked under his bed and his dresser drawers and his closet. And I seen a gun. And it looked just like my gun. And my first thought was, why does Leland have my gun? But then I looked at it, it was a toy gun. But the weight was the same as the weight of the gun. It looked like a gun. So I took the gun and I gave it to my father. And I told my son, see, my son came home, Mama, where is my, I had a BB gun that my daddy gave me. And I said, I took it to that grandfather's house because it looks like a real gun. And the police officer would see you with that gun, they're not going to ask you no questions. They can probably shoot you first because it looks like a real gun. And he was very upset. He said, but it's a toy. Yes, it's a toy, but if I couldn't tell it was a toy, how would a police officer tell it was a toy? And some
Can I speak on that? This is Scout. And because, you know, I'm one of those, I was a scout, but I was a scoutmaster for a long, long time. And we're inside of Boy Scouts. We, Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, we do talk about firearm safety and BB guns and all that type of stuff. And I'm also a gun owner, and I've taught my sons over time about using weapons. And the one thing that I have to go out there and I like to emphasize to every parent, that one, if you had a BB gun, is not a toy. It says it on the outside of a box. It's not a toy. It's actually a hunting instrument. You can actually hunt with it. You can kill with a BB gun. It is not a toy. And even those airsoft guns that people are, that the young man got, that had, the young man had up in Cleveland. Airsoft guns are not toys. People don't understand that. They are a training implement. Now, people use them in gaming and hunting and whatnot, but they are not toys. And you have to know, you know, and once you get past that point, like, for instance, we have airsoft guns in my house. My sons know, and if they get caught with it outside just randomly playing with it, that's a no-no, because there's certain places in which you can go to play with these guns around other people that are in safe environments. You know, if you got to go transport it, there's a proper way to transport it. Like, you're supposed to put a orange sock or something over the barrel if you're carrying it, even if you're just hunting. You know, until you get to the spot where you're hunting. There's a lot of rules that go along with that. And I explained that to my sons a long time ago, because you can get shot, but even though you're not supposed to, particularly if you're living in a state like Georgia where we have open carry laws. No one is supposed to be shooting you anyway, because if you're carrying a gun, nobody should be, the cops are not even supposed to be allowed to talk to you about your gun. But we keep finding that as African Americans, that law doesn't apply to us, so we have to go with the old rule of one, just don't go out, you don't go outside and play with it unless you have, you know, you let people know. And if you see the cops going, you drop the joker. I mean, I live in a rural area. So, you know, you see kids outside playing all the time. They go out there and they like to play war. They play cops and robbers. They play, you know, cowboys and Indians, which is the craziest thing in the world if kids still play that. But, you know, I call it, y'all out here playing genocide. But anyway, you know, we have to really take, their parents need to really take account to the fact that these are not toys. And, you know, you just don't allow your children to run around with open access to them, because even when they come back into my house, we put them up. Put them up, don't touch them. If you want to touch it, you need to ask somebody. You get caught touching without asking somebody, it gets confiscated. So, I mean, you know, I'm really glad that when you found that, because there have been so many kids that have gotten in trouble for bluffing with those things, taking them to school, because if you take one to school, they don't care if it's plastic, real, or whatever. They're going to charge you just like it was the real thing.
Uh-huh.
That's correct. My son says everything, too, and that's correct. But a lot of parents, they allow their kids to have these items. They don't teach them about these items. They sell them at Walmart. And kids come in there, Mom, I want this. Their parents will buy it. But you have to understand there are certain things that we should not allow our children to play with without proper instruction.
Well, Janice, I would like to know, because you are an advocate, what are some things that you would suggest to parents, specifically when they have young black male youth, that they would do to prevent, because, you know, I'm understanding from what you do, you're saying that you can even prevent some of this police brutality before they even leave home. What are things that you would suggest that people do, specifically those that have young black male youth at home?
I always tell my son and other kids, always carry your ID. I tell you one incident. My son, he has white friends and Indian friends that he used to play with in the neighborhood. One time, the police officer stopped them, and one of their friends, one of the little white boys, he says, "Why are you stopping us? We got rights. We can walk on the street." The police officer asked them where they were going and what they were doing. The whole group of them, it was after dark, and they didn't want to show their ID. And I explained to my son, there are bad cops, there are good cops, there are criminals in every profession. But if a police officer stops you and questions you, just answer the question. Keep your hands visible at all times. If he asks you your ID, show him your ID. Because, like I told him, if you're in trouble, who are you going to call? You always call the police, because they are here to protect and serve. But they also have a right to protect themselves. So you should always your kids to, first of all, respect the law. Plain and simple. You respect the law. You respect your teachers and you respect other adults. But these kids today, they see so much, they hear racism, but they really don't understand real racism. You know, I grew up in the 70s. I understand real racism. And you try to teach your kids to just do the right thing, to obey the law, like that Michael Brown situation. Now, the only crime that Michael Brown was accused of was jaywalking. That does not deserve a death sentence. I don't know what happened with the car. I don't know how he got to the car, all the other stuff. But in retrospect, but one right, one wrong don't make a right. If he would have got out the street and moved over to the sidewalk, all that could have been prevented. But if he doesn't give Officer Wilson the right to kill him, and Officer Wilson committed a crime, in my opinion, because he was the adult in the situation. But
you know, and I'm going to interject this, Jared. I agree with Janice, because at the end of the day, Officer Wilson created, you know, he actually committed a crime. But our grand jury, which was made of 9 whites and then 3 blacks, actually found that he did not commit a crime. But you have to look at the whole system again and the evidence that was given to the grand jury. And as it looks further into it, the prosecuting attorney was friends with the police officer's family, and he had other connections and ties. So, of course, he's going to look out for his own. And that's the problem with the whole system. It should have been a neutral person, probably in a neutral location, and let that grand jury make a decision. But instead, what we did was, we allow for a white prosecutor with ties to the officer to persuade a grand jury that, hey, this is what should be known, and these are the facts you need to know. And most grand juries, the person that's being indicted never knows there's a grand jury investigation. But here, Darren Wilson was actually called to testify in his grand jury hearing, which is really unheard of. So, I mean, is that justice? No, it really isn't, because, of course, if he can come and testify, he's going to get off, because he's only giving his side of the story.
There was only one side told.
Now, I would like to bring up the devil's advocate. I saw a Facebook post that was posted by a legal expert as well, and the Facebook post referenced Pharrell Williams, in which Pharrell Williams stated that he was more concerned about Michael Brown's behavior in the store. He said everybody keeps saying that, you know, of course Michael Brown did not deserve this. He said, but no one's focusing on Michael Brown's behavior. Now, I see truth in both comments because, for one, you have a child that even though that situation in the store didn't have anything to do with him walking in the street, the behavior, the mentality that he went into the store to bully the store owner, rob the store, and then he was caught jaywalking.
But at the time, Officer Wilson had no idea that the store incident had even happened.
I agree. No, I agree with
now,
you.
Now, let me bring up a point right quick, Christy.
Mm-hmm.
Let me bring up a point that something that just developed in the last couple of days dealing with the store situation that you've not heard anybody talk about on the media, but it's come up and it's the store owner himself from that store. The store owner from that store is not even sure. It was not she has spoken out and has actually attempted to tell the police that, one, he don't think it was Michael Brown who was the one he was having a problem with in the video. That
mm-hmm.
is the thing that just came out.
That the
store owner himself has actually said and has tried on several occasions to let people know that that may have not even been Michael Brown in the video. Because if you go back to the statement given by his friend that was with him, and we keep forgetting Michael Brown wasn't alone. They said they went to go buy some cigars, some cigarillos. The ones that they wanted in the beginning was too much. So Mike gave those back. The store owner caught an attitude because he didn't want to exchange those. He didn't want to give them back. And Mike was like, I want to take these because I can afford these. And he threw those back at him, and then those got thrown back. That's two different types of. If you look at the videos, that's two different videos there. And this has been brought up, but nobody wants to talk about it. That Mike Brown actually purchased those, and. Then there was a robbery right too long after that. Somebody picked up the ones that he threw down and walked out the store with them.
That's what
the store owner has been saying. But nobody in the store owner, he's been trying to say that since the beginning. But that goes back to something else that Jared has talked about earlier about voting and this, that, and other, and having control of our government. Because Officer Wilson, 18 months before this incident, belonged to another police department in Missouri that was disbanded. They were disbanded. It was a vote in that city council 6-1. It was a town called, I think it was Juliet, Missouri or whatever. The city is 89% African American. Police force, 45 members, 100% white. They had been for years and years and years kept getting complaints. They were doing stuff like snatching people off of their porches and beating them. I mean, it was crazy. And finally, the city council, they got so tired of going through complaints that they fired every last policeman on that police department, including Officer Wilson, and disbanded their police force and started over again. So he learned, and this was his first job.
Well, I didn't bring up the point to say that it had anything to do with the case. My point in my angle in bringing that up is what is going on with the mentality of the people, of these young boys that are going out and having problems with the police. I think it's much deeper. If there's some sort of indication of some bullying behavior, the reason why I bring that post up about Pharrell Williams is because there was a comment. Where I was headed with this is that there was a comment, I think made by one of our listeners who's on now. Her name is Joan. She made a comment, and she said, what person would let their child walk in the middle of the street when you should be respectful enough to walk on the sidewalk? She said that in itself doesn't deserve him to die, but it shows an indication of parenting. So I bring this up because I think it's interesting that Jared focused on basic human rights. And sometimes I think we as African Americans, we forget that that's just as important, if not more important, than a Bill of Rights, because our human rights and how we carry ourselves affects the rights that we're giving in other avenues of life. I mean, even as I was talking to the loss prevention officer, he was talking about the urban wear that you see kids in the store wearing. He said one thing he notices as he watches these young men and women is that they will come in the store and make a mess. He said then you'll see the heavy clothing with no just disregard to the public. He said when you take all of that into consideration, yes, you will be on the police radar, even if you have no malicious intention. So, you know, going back to our basic rights, which is being able to clothe ourselves properly, being able to come outside and behave in a civil mental behavior, you know, what is happening where we kind of throw that out the window?
Well, I got some opinions on that one, and one of those comes back to something that I know me, you, and Derek been talked about, and that is that, yeah, true enough, there's some parenting issues in there, but the other part of it that a lot of people don't want to take a look at, and it's more something that's on a psychological basis. And I watched this when I worked in a group home with young men, and I watched those particularly who had oppositional defiance disorder. You know, if you look at those who don't deal with authority properly, one, there's the lack of respect not only comes, it's something that they've learned as a coping mechanism, because authority is something that is seen to hurt them. Everything in their life that's supposed to have authority over them has hurt them or caused them some type of problem. So therefore, to defend themselves against that authority, they become in opposition to it. You have to realize that we don't operate in a bubble. And a lot of folks, you know, we try to take and compartmentalize our different issues to our time frame, but some of it's generational. When you've been living in a country in which you've been progressing out of oppression for 400 years, and you get there, because I know growing up, and I go into the store where the Indian guys own the store, and I'm walking around the store, and I'm not criminal-minded in no form or fashion, but I walk into the store, and you come out from behind the counter, and you walk behind me, and I'm trying to make a decision, do I want Reese's Cups, or do I want Kit Kats, and you sitting there yelling at me, you need to make your mind up, I'm coming to patronize your store, telling you to give you money, don't rush me on my decision. I'm sitting here making that's a heavy decision when you're a teenager. Do I want you to come or do I want Kit Kat? You know what I'm saying? You know, I don't want to sit there yelling at me about that. So then you're yelling at me, you're disrespecting me as a human being. I'm a young man. I'm trying to define myself as a man, and you diminishing my manhood by yelling at me, trying to force me to make a decision that I'm trying to give you my money. You don't respect me enough to me to give you my money like I deserve, like I'm owed to give you my money. Then I walk out the street, and the police are looking at me, and I had these same problems growing up. It's just the police weren't so quick to pull the trigger on us back then. But they were quick to whip our ass, and excuse my language. But it's my damn shirt, so I'm going to say what I want to say. But, you know, it's like, yeah, I remember when I was growing up, there was a cop who used to come through the park, and he used to tell us to run. And whoever he caught, he was whipping their ass. And we became very fast. We got real fast because he found some enjoyment in that. You know what I'm saying? We complained and we did this and that. It took years for them to remove that cop from our presence. You know what I'm saying? I remember growing up, if you're from Atlanta, you remember Red Dog, or you remember Black Cat if you were from DeKalb County. Yep. Hey, that was their job, to run around and whoop our tail. You know, that was their job, to run around and whoop our tail. So...
Wait, Scott, I think we have a caller that wants to speak.
No, this is Joan.
I have something to say. I agree with what Ms. Janice was saying about being responsible, because how many of you think that if you had walked up to Mr. Brown and said, hey, as a man, like maybe Derek said to him, hey, man, get out of the street, do you think he would have took that offensively, or would you think he would have just got out of the street? So sometimes
I think a brother from the neighborhood had walked up on him. He might have gotten on the street a little quicker than he was if he had been the police. I actually do believe that, because I've had that conversation with young men in my own community. I asked them to do something, and I went to them like, hey, bro, you know these folk running around here. You know how they do. you might want to get on the sidewalk. And they'd be like, yeah, Mr. Elliott, you're right. I'm going to go and get up on this sidewalk. They pull their little pants up, they get on the sidewalk. I think if a brother from the neighborhood had approached them with that, that would have been fine. So that also comes back to us again as a community, why we don't take responsibility when we see them doing wrong, why we waiting for the police to come up because we know what they're going to do.
And that was what I was about to say. Sometimes I think people have to
understand. You don't know how to actually quote him because there are criminals on the police force, 554, in the banking industry. There are criminals everywhere. So I don't know how Officer Wilson actually spoke to that young man and if he took offense to how he spoke to him. So I don't know that whole story, but I just know that this. If jaywalking is a crime that's not punished by murder, that's all I know. So
well,
I don't
exactly,
know how
I feel that someone had probably walked up to him. If someone had walked up to him and asked him to remove himself from the street, I don't think he would have probably moved himself from the street. I believe Scott is saying because someone said, okay, Scott, because they knew you, maybe they would have. But I think a lot of young black kids are very defiant because they feel that they have the right for everything because I think they're fools, and I think they don't understand that the law is the law, and it doesn't really matter if they're black or white. If you see kids walking around with their pants hanging down, and we say to them, hey, man, why don't you pull your pants up? My brother had the same conversation with his son while he was home when my brother got shot. He had the same conversation. Hey, man, pull your pants up on you. You're around the family. My little nephew got mad. He was fighting mad about it. So sometimes I think we underestimate what we're teaching our children because we don't teach them properly. That's just my opinion, though.
Yeah, and that's where I'm basically.
And, John, I agree. I mean, because I can see where you're going. And so, you know, if he was walking with his friends and the police officer came up and said, hey, get out the street, you know, he want to be, he may, and I don't know this for a fact, but he may want to show off and be like, hey, be defiant and go against authority. Not saying that was a cause for him to get shot because he shouldn't have been shot. But I could see where he could rebel against authority, especially if he was trying to show off. And a lot of that goes back to the home training and say, hey, you know, we have to teach our kids to respect authority.
I agree.
Yeah,
here.
I think that's
the
I
was really surprised when Levin was arguing with the police officer about showing his ID. Now, I was not there, so, but when I came outside and I seen the police car and I see them arguing with the police officer, I'm like, really, what's the problem? Show your ID. You know, then of course they showed the CID. And the police officer, he was a very nice gentleman. And he was a white police officer, but he patrols our neighborhood. And I told him, the police are here to protect and serve us. They protect us. So why are you arguing with the police? Well, why do you need my ID? I'm just walking down the street. Well, he didn't only ask for your ID. He asked for Kenneth's ID, which is a white young man. He asked for Dorian's ID. And Dorian is a Japanese young fellow. He asked for all y'all's ID. He doesn't ask for your ID. But all y'all can argue with the police, but y'all don't have to show your ID. And the police officer never got in his car. He was like, y'all need to calm down. I want to be y'all belong over here. And I was telling him, he patrols our area, and he hadn't seen you, so he just want to know who you are. And do you belong over here? Because we have had break-ins and stuff over here. So just be polite, show your ID, and he'll let you move on. And after they showed his ID, he introduced himself to them, shook their hands, and told them, okay. So,
but see, I think what some of the problem leads into, and I'm gonna give you an experience that I have that I see here in the streets, and not just in African American communities, but in communities where you have underprivileged and underserved people. Period. They have some of the same mentalities that we see when our troops are overseas in countries that we're occupying. You have the same type of reaction that takes place from those young people there because, one, you know, we are taught in school one thing, but we're presented with something else in public because we're taught that, one, only in countries where there are pressure do people walk up to you and say, can I see your papers, please? You know, that's all. We're taught that this is something that they done in Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany. We're taught this in school. So then you come out and you walk in an American street and somebody walks up to you, may I see your identification? It doesn't sound like my papers, please, or it doesn't sound like, let me see, you know, are your papers in order? but that's what it is. And so you're taught that in school, and you're taught to even resist that in school, or at least you were when you were our age. You were taught to resist that. So you got this mentality that some of them feel like they're in occupied territory, that they are fighting their resistance. That's what they feel like. And so you have, and it's a part of the male psyche, I almost believe sometimes, to be defiant because people are trying to come at your freedom. And, I mean, yeah, true enough, show your identification. I tell my sons that all the time, show your ID. If you're in the car, put your hands in clear sight. You know, don't fuck with them. Now, I will fuck with them. Now, I've been known to fuck with them, but I'm a community leader down here. So, therefore, if I fuck with you, I'm daring you to do something to me so I can get in the newspaper and talk about you. I'm daring you. You know what I'm saying? I double dog dare you. So, it's like, but only certain people can do that, and you got to know who you are when you're pulling that stunt. But, you know, because that stunt shit could get your behind wheel, because he might be, I don't give a crap mood that day. But I still see where you're coming from also, because we don't do enough to tell our children, listen, comply, because we love you and we don't want to see nothing happen to you but comply. But why have we gotten into the mindset that we have to comply with something that we know is wrong?
Well, when you say we have to comply with something that we know is wrong, I mean, let's just be real about this. You comply with a lot of things every day. You know, majority of African-Americans experience some sort of racism and they comply. That's just the order of life until we own, as Jared said, we own no property. So we own no property. We don't have any ownership in this country economically, very little. So our power is diminished. So we have to tell our children, look, until we can get to this status in life, you may have to remain silent. And I think the problem is we're not enforcing that. And it creates more of a hectic environment. You know, I was talking to the loss prevention officer yesterday, and he said one of the things that he was happy about was that as a young black male, he was able to leave New York. And he brought up an interesting point. He said because in New York, after a certain time at night, he said probably 9 o'clock at night, you'd see the police officers just rounding black men up, harassing them, rounding them up. He said he himself had been stopped by a police officer in a truck. The police officer jumped, came out of nowhere, whispered in his ear. He said, sorry, I'm doing this because my lieutenant wants me to do it. He said the guy searched him. And he said he went back and talked to his lieutenant, and they left him alone. He said, but plenty of my friends are locked up in jail over frivolous things that other people wouldn't be in jail over. So I think sometimes the reality that we have to face is we will have to remain silent and be respectful until we do gain some sort of economic power. Until then, you know, I don't know how you're supposed to talk back or stand up for yourself and be safe.
Well,
you know,
the first thing
the first thing
I believe that we do to stand up goes back to something Jared said, is that you got to become politically active, because I'm going to tell you something that I've learned is being a chairperson of a local Democratic Party, that when you go into, I got certain precincts that I can go look into, and if that precinct has better services, better, you know, sidewalks, the streets are paved more often, repairs take place, and I can go look at the voter turnout in that precinct. And I can promise you that the voter turnout is usually somewhere in the high 60s, high 70s. If I go to a precinct that is underserved and they're not getting the services and the police are there a lot, I can look at the voter turnout, and it's usually below 40, usually tracing somewhere around 25% to 30%. So if you're looking at the one that people are not going to, the politicians know. They know. Well, I'm not going to have any problems out of it because the folks that's voting for me in that underserved precinct are going to vote anyway. I ain't going to have no problems out of those people. So, therefore,
but I challenge you.
I can do what I want
to. To me, that sounds great in an ideal world. But I challenge you to look at all the voter turnouts that we've had where there was, you know, misrepresentation of people. I even challenge you to think about people that are stopped every day that voted, that are a part of their political affiliation.
But
I mean,
it,
I can even speak to my...
I'm not saying it's your political affiliation. What I'm saying is it's done geographically.
I just want to speak even for myself. You know, I remember driving in my car at night by myself, and I have been stopped twice, you know. And so now in these instances, I don't think, even if I contacted my chairperson, I don't know what it would have done for me at that moment, because I was driving by myself. The police officer pulled me over. He didn't even get out of his car. He turned his lights on, and he said, "Will you please step out the car?" Now, I'm scared because he's asking me to step out of my car. I've never experienced anything like that, because usually an officer would get out of their car and come to you, but he asked me to step out. He turned on the bright searchlights. I got out the car. He said, "Put your hands up." I put my hands up. I followed his order. Now, I don't know what he was looking for. I stood outside for about maybe 10, 15 minutes with my hands up in the air, and eventually he drove off and he left me standing there. I had another officer stop me because I had an air freshener in my car. I had been to the car wash. I had an air freshener in my car that I really didn't even pay attention to, because I let the guys wash my car, and they put a marijuana air freshener. The police pulled me over because he said of the air freshener made him suspicious of me being a drug, I guess, carrier, carrying drugs. So he, him and some other officers, he called for backup, and they searched my car. Now, you know, I in an ideal world, I would like to say at that moment that I would get on my phone and call someone. So I'm just pointing out realistic things that happen to people every day, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, but I'm just challenging us to really think about in a broader scope of what's happening to these young black males every day, where they may not have access to a family member. A lot of these people that are in these communities don't have the type of access where they're aware of who their chairperson is. So
this is a problem. This is a problem. You know, if you go ask the average American, and this ain't even in underserved communities, you got to ask the average American, black, white, Latino, Asian, who are the people that represent you in government? They can't even tell you. They can't tell you. That's a responsibility we have to take for ourselves, because you can easily find that information out just by calling down to your local. You can call a police station and they'll tell you, you know, how to get in contact with somebody. I mean, so that's something that we got to take on ourselves. And we sit here and we complain about we're getting misrepresented. We're getting, you know, kicked down, beat down, shot. It's just like in Ferguson. Ferguson has a 12% turnout rate in the election. Okay? The majority of their city council is white. They could very easily, the way that makeup is made up in Ferguson, get something done. Matter of fact, I'm thinking of going to Ferguson in April, because they have elections up there, and I got some people who are involved that are politically going up there trying to help get some people elected. Because one of the things that's going on is that those people can't even tell you. Now they know, because they've been seeing their faces on TV. They couldn't even tell you who their state senator was. They know who she is now. Everybody knows who she is now because she's been on television. They know who their one city council person is now. Why? Because she's been on television speaking up for them. But the problem is, why didn't you know that before these things have been going on?
Can I speak on something?
Yes, go ahead.
There's a few things that y'all talked about. You talked about the low turnout in the polls. You talked about not voting. What you're not talking about is when you do vote and you don't have money to back the person that you voted for, the agenda that person is on.
One second. We have a caller that just called in. Caller?
Hello. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hey,
I
live in Maryland. And I just tuned in. I just, you know, I'm constantly scanning to see what's going on around the country and around the world. And I've been listening, and I heard something about how to respond to the police and how we should just accept different things because we don't have land or something like that. Well, we have to look at, you know, ourselves by looking at our history. When we were enslaved, we still rebelled. We had rebellions. We didn't have land then. You cannot accept oppression because you feel like you don't have things. I mean, if you think like that, Rosa Parks, you know, and other people that refuse to continue to accept craziness. I mean, they risk being beaten up or whatever. You cannot sit back and say, well, because there's a threat, I'm going to do nothing. I'm going to accept this stuff. That's not the solution. You don't do that. You look, have to look at your history. That's why we had the Black Panther Party and many other groups. They did not sit down and say, well, we're going to keep accepting police beating us up and killing us in our communities. So you have to look at your history. Yes.
Can I ask you a question? Which part of Maryland are you from?
I'm right outside of D.C.
Okay, because I was asking because I noticed that if I talk to people from Maryland, particularly those folks who are from the Eastern Shore part going toward like Delaware, there's a completely different thought pattern out of those people, the African American population that's in that area versus the rest of Maryland. Period. So I was just wondering.
But that's like another planet over there. I mean, really, it's like you've gone to another planet when you go over there.
Can you explain that? Can you explain that in detail, the difference of the two, the Twilight Zone experience?
Well, it seems like people over there don't have access to newspapers, books, television, and reality. I went over there to buy some material from a store, and these people looked at me like, they don't see many Black people. And I'm like, don't these fools see, read the paper and know what's going on in the world? And, you know, it was just really bizarre. And I just stopped going over there because, I mean, they were just unaccustomed to civilization, really. They
what's
so
the crime rate
over
there?
Over in that
and
area?
Education. Yeah, education and crime level. What's the crime level in education over there?
I'm not that familiar with it because, like I said, it's like off the radar over here, and not too many people go over there because you got to really go out of your way to go over there.
Yeah,
and it's like hidden away behind the Iron Curtain.
Gotcha.
But I like what you were saying. Can you continue when you were saying that the Black Panther, you were speaking on the Black Panther and the history?
Right. I don't know if you remember, but you may be able to go on YouTube. The Black Panther Party, I grew up in the 60s, and back before people had afros. When the Black Panther Party picked up guns, because it was legal to have open guns, open carry in California. They went to the state house with guns drawn and had to explain some things to the representatives there. I remember waking up one morning, turning on television and seeing this on the news. So Black people have a history of resistance, and you have to continue to resist this all-out war, race war on Black people. We've been involved in a race war since we got here. And, I don't know what we're looking for when we hear people trying to figure out, well, what's going on? Do you need to retrain the police? No, you don't need to retrain the police. We are involved in a race war on Black people, plain and simple.
All right.
So, we have to realize,
this is the bottom line. There are no rules in a race war. That's why the courts and all of this other stuff are not doing anything.
I agree with you, caller. So what I'm going to ask you, are you saying that the police, the government, are preparing for a form of civil war, a form of revolution, an uprising of Black people?
I'm not saying that. It's informal. It's like the understanding is, we can get away with killing them. We can shoot them 50 times. If you go to shooting range or you go to one of these places where they kill animals in these parks for money,
right.
If you shoot at an elephant 50 times, they kick you out of there and call you crazy. But you can shoot at Black people 50 times, and it's, transportation doesn't stop in America. People move right on. This is nuts.
What's our solution to that? What's our solution to that, brother? How do we combat that? How do we stop that? Do we bear arms ourselves legally?
No. The first realization we have to do understand our history. We are people of struggle. Nobody just sit down one day and say, hey, you know what? We tired of keeping these people in bondage. Let's let them go. That's not the way it happens. There's always been resistance. Now, what we have to do is first understand what we are against. That's the biggest hurdle that we have to overcome. We have to stop fumbling around here trying to figure out why are we being shot down like you're not even shooting dogs like this. If people were shooting dogs like we are being shot, they would be in jail.
Michael Vick.
Didn't we have a football player to go to jail?
Michael Vick.
Absolutely. He didn't kill any people, and as a matter of fact, I don't even think he killed a dog. But he went to jail.
And there's
nobody goes to jail for murdering us.
There's actually a case of a 16-year-old who just got convicted for 23 years in prison for killing a dog. And at the same time that the indictment was coming out against Mike Brown. And then I've seen the two or three videos that I saw in which you had white men actively brandishing their guns, shooting guns, doing whatever, and the police are surrounding them. Nobody takes a shot. I think of Derek, you probably seen the video that I showed you, the one dude in San Diego. He running around acting a fool with a gun, and they trying to talk to him the whole time. Finally, they shoot him. But when they did shoot him, they shot him once, and they shot him in the guts. And then they had already called the ambulance when they knew they were getting ready to shoot him, so they scooped him right on up and took him to the hospital and sewed him up so they could take him to jail and convict him. Now, my question was, there couldn't have been a brother because the brother had been dead, and we would have been waiting 2 hours for the for the doggone ambulance to come cover him up to just verify he was dead.
Absolutely.
So call him, brother. So we're aware of what's going on. We understand that we're on the radar. So, again, my question to you is, what is our solution? Is it an economic solution?
Brother, the problem is we are not aware. I have people that I send out email to and articles, videos, and people respond back to me that we are not in a war. They're saying that the last email I got said that white folk are angry because of our successes. So I don't know anybody that I've talked to that agree with me. They try to tell me, no, it's something else. And I say,
well, I'm letting you know now, I agree with you.
We agree with you. I agree with you.
We agree with you
100%. Agree with you, brother. You are not alone. And this is what I'm trying to say. What I'm trying to say, I'm not talking about those lost souls. You're always going to have those lost souls that follow. We're not talking about them. I'm asking you to address the individuals who are clear what the problem is and why we're being persecuted the way that we're being persecuted and shot. What is our solution?
Well, I think that we have to continue to open the eyes of other people, because I think there needs to be an organic solution. There's not a solution of going out and buying guns. Guns are very expensive compared to what they used to be. And that's not a solution for us. When you hear our people, these so-called representatives that we vote for, going around, 99% of them are really not giving us any kind of answers. When you hear our people saying that we are under attack, that's going to have a difference. Because our people right now are not facing reality, and most people will say, I don't know what's going on. But the majority of us, very few of us, are actually saying, look, we are in a race war, and people know that they can murder us and nothing happens. And there are very few people. We have to continue to open people's eyes. I mean,
So what you're saying is we got to keep putting the word out. Now, we keep putting the word out. Let's say we put the word out for 5 years, for 10 years, for 20 years, and it still happens. What is our solution?
Well, I definitely don't think that when we open enough eyes that things are going to be rocking along like this for 5 or 10 years, because just like right now where you have people upset and saying that they're not going to spend money, people are going to change some habits. And you
That's
don't
right.
want, you know, you don't want people, these other folk don't want people going around with their eyes open. You start telling them, when you meet folk and they ask you, well, what you think going on, you tell them, well, we're in a race war, and see their reaction. They don't want you to understand what's happening to you and the way it looks right now when you look at television, which I don't have, but when you look out, read papers, these people understand and they know that we as a group really don't know what's happening to us, and they're not going to tell us. Because you know.
I 100% agree with you. I 100% agree with you.
Absolutely.
I think we're actually scared to admit that we are in this situation. I mean, because like you said, one, if we were to admit to ourselves that we were in a actual war footing, that means that we would need to raise an army. And, you know, to use a word that my sons like to use all the time, I don't think we're about that life. I don't think we are. You know what I'm saying? For real, I don't think we're about that life, because nobody's going to want to go out there and leave their comfortable homes to take up arms and go fight like some of our forefathers did, who donned on blue uniforms during the Civil War to go help fight for our own freedom. You know what I'm saying? Nobody's going to want to go live like our soldiers in Afghanistan to help us get our own freedom. Nobody's going to want to do that. They want to go to Black Friday. They want to buy cheap television. We want Gucci purses and Coach bags. We want to drive BMWs and Mercedes and Cadillacs and buy a house we can't afford and act like we free.
I would like to say we have 3 minutes left and 34 seconds, and I'm loving the views of the guest caller. So I would like for our guest caller to end us with some of his perceptions and what he sees, that, you know, just things that you think that we need to do moving forward.
Well, what I do is, like I say, I constantly talk to people and I listen to people. And I send out, you know, information. And I made some changes about what I buy. And I think that's the number one thing that we can do. Once we inform people, people are going to make some decisions about what they are spending their money on. Because when you realize you are in a critical situation, which is, you know, we've been in a critical situation for a long time. I have kinfolk in Texas. These people are not talking about how much hell you have to go through to even try to vote. I mean, with all this so-called identification, they've been voting for 40 years, and now you don't know whether or not your vote is even being counted. A lot of people are being even discouraged, and no Democrats are talking about it. Miss Clinton, Mr. Clinton, none of them. They just accepted the fact that we have been disenfranchised. This is not acceptable. This should be front page for us. I mean, nobody's going to come up here and take our votes. And then the president talking about what he's getting ready to do for the immigrants. What about us? We can barely vote. And so many of us are, you know, just drunk on the president. He can do no wrong. But where's well, his mouth?
Not all of us. I'm a card-carrying member of the party, and I'm not drunk on it.
Yes, I can hear everything. But we are on our own. We used to have what they call a black caucus. When has the last time you heard anything from them? I haven't heard anything. I've sent letters.
They've been paid off.
But, I mean, you got the Congress people from Missouri. They're not talking? Where are they talking?
Question: are we conquered people as a whole? Are we conquered? Are we Frankensteins of what we used to be?
You say, are we conquered people?
Yes, are we conquered people collectively, black people? Are we conquered?
Mentally is our biggest problem. We have a lot of work to do. I've been looking at videos on YouTube where people have done interviews with people on the streets of New York. When I was young, I used to think people in New York were advanced because I lived in the Deep South. I never thought people in New York would be stopped on the street, hundreds of thousands of black people, and searched and told to get up against the wall, and the city continues to function. I don't think you can do that in Alabama and black people put up with it. I'm astonished that they're putting up with it in New York City.
It's a military state in New York City. I'm from Harlem.
I mean, I can't believe
it. It's a military state.
With a couple
okay, guys,
that
we got
10
seconds
know,
left in the show. And
I
want to thank everybody.
Out.
Yeah, I want to thank y'all. Y'all have a good one. And keep continuing to listen in and tune in next Sunday where we'll be talking about relationships. So with that being said, this is Down South and Dirty with Scott Smith. See you next Sunday.
Thank you.
Good show.